Okay, here we go. The training world is full of technical editing courses that don't teach the high-end creativity that viewers expect. Inside the Edit was created specifically to teach you every single creative skill you'll ever need to mesmerize your audience. Hi everybody, great to have you back on another episode of Once Upon a Timeline, the official podcast of Inside the Edit, the world's only professional level creative editing course. I'm your host, Paddy Bird, and thank you so much for joining me for this week's show. So, what have we got for episode 14? Well, today we are going to be discussing journalistic compression, the art of selecting essential sync. Yet another creative subject I love. It is absolutely essential as an editing skill. And it's another subject that is, again, not talked about in our community, you know, which is crazy. Anyone who devotes a significant amount of time to mastering it really does set themselves apart from the crowd in terms of their, you know, in terms of their creative abilities. Now, before we start on that, we've got a few updates for you. Firstly, I am super excited to say that we are tantalizingly close to having our new bootcamp page up on insidetheedit.com. I know I've hinted at it in a few previous episodes. So, if you want to learn an enormous amount of creative editing theory that is not taught anywhere else, then the Inside the Edit Bootcamp is for you. If you want to compress all that high-end learning into an intense weekend of study, then the Inside Bootcamp is what you're looking for. And if you want to do it in a live environment from anywhere in the world, then the Inside the Edit Bootcamp is what you've been looking for. We're building it right now and it's looking really awesome. So I'm going to give you a few more details on that later in the show. And secondly, we have a brand new competition this week. Someone is going to win the complete set of raw footage to one of our documentaries. Yes, you'll be able to practice cutting one of our compelling films in tons of different ways, in tons of different variations. And, you know, this is the ultimate way to sharpen your narrative skills as an editor, and a really great way to show clients the range of your talents and abilities. So stay tuned, and I'll be announcing what you have to do to win after this week's creative discussion. With that in mind, let's get started. One of my favorite films of all time is the 1991 classic, The Silence of the Lambs. Although it was rated 18 here in the UK, I remember my local video store owner renting it to the 16-year-old me the week it came out. He saw me, you know, more than my parents did at that point in my life, as I was, you know, movie crazy. And so we'd built up quite a friendship. And while making sure that none of the other customers were watching, he kindly broke the law and handed me the VHS cassette with a little knowing wink. I remember watching it with my then girlfriend that very night, and while she let out screams of horror at all the really scary parts, I actually pretended not to be just as petrified in order to impress her. You know, the things a 16-year-old young man will do to impress a young lady. I had actually developed this trick of looking just above the TV when something nasty was going to happen, so I wouldn't have to actually watch it. And to anyone else in the room who looked at me, my eyeline gave the impression that I was watching every single frame of the film. It was Anthony Hopkins' performance of the psychiatrist serial killer Hannibal Lecter that completely captivated me. I'd never seen anything like it. He terrified me. Quite rightly, he got an Oscar for his efforts. And then he went on to star in two more films as the cannibalistic head doctor. But in a film with so many memorable scenes, there was a tiny part of one of them that really stood out for me. FBI agent Clarice Starling, played by the amazing Jodie Foster, who also earned an Oscar for her performance, is on the hunt for a serial killer and enlists the help of the psychotic psychiatrist, who by that point has been in jail for many years. And she's got to do it before the killer strikes again. It's a race against time, but to Hannibal, it's all a game as he toys with Clarice and enjoys the game of intellectual cat and mouse. Now, in the scene in question, Hannibal sits in his cage, listening to Bach on his tape recorder, and Clarice hounds him to help her before it's too late. And it was this speech which really piqued my curiosity. "First principles, Clarice," Hannibal says. "Simplicity. Read Marcus Aurelius. Of each particular thing, ask what is it in itself? What is its nature?" Now, I'd heard about the Roman emperor and Stoic philosopher Marcus Aurelius from school. And 8 years later, in 1999, he would be played by the legendary Richard Harris in Ridley Scott's masterpiece Gladiator, where a young Joaquin Phoenix would commit one of the silver screen's most notorious patricides on him in the first act of the film. But I'd never heard of this phrase, first principles, and so I looked it up. What on earth did it mean? I remember something about it just jumped out at me, and it sounded really intriguing. And I wasn't disappointed by what I discovered. Over the centuries, the concept of first principles has been used by great thinkers to solve complicated problems and really unleash creative possibility. Everyone from the 4th century BC Greek philosopher Aristotle to the 21st century entrepreneur Elon Musk use the idea of reverse engineering complexity by breaking it down into the most basic elements and reassembling them from the ground up. Aristotle defined first principles as the first basis from which a thing is known. Forget everyone else's distorted opinions. You know, go right back to the start. Clear the deck. And with an empty mind, build and question everything while you're constructing. You know, it doesn't matter if it's a logical argument or a philosophy or a scientific concept or, a political point of view. It could even be the recipe for a bowl of soup. First principles slice through dogma and show us how to build something complex from nothing. Sound familiar? Yep, the parallels to our beautiful art form are very strong. As we all know, one of our many roles as an editor is to be the first audience. We're here as the kind of, emotional test dummy that's repeatedly driven into the wall of every new sequence to see if the narrative airbag works. If the film doesn't entertain us, or, we don't understand parts of it, then it definitely won't entertain the audience, and they'll have parts that they won't understand either. Now, any pro editor fully comprehends their role in assuming a point of view of, complete ignorance when building and then watching a sequence. Because, that's one of the ways in which we replicate the fresh and untainted mind of a viewer. It's never 100% accurate, but we try and get as close to the center of the dartboard as possible. Now, I'm actually a really slow learner, and I always have been since I was young. I need to repeat things over and over again in my mind in order for it to really sink in and for me to fully understand a new concept. But despite me thinking that this would hamper me in editing, it actually did me a favor. This position of slow learning and ignorance constantly made me question the structure of many of the sequences I've built throughout my career. You know, as a lifelong sponge for knowledge from great thinkers, I've always used the concept of first principles when constructing anything new. And I've always assumed that the audience knows nothing about what we're talking about in any one film. They need us to carve a coherent path for them to follow. And this is especially true in non-scripted genres like documentary or entertainment. Let's take a macro view of the early stages of a non-scripted edit. You know, we start sifting through and organizing material. We categorize it and subcategorize it so that it's an easily accessible and highly organized kind of digital filing cabinet, really, that allows us to pull up and find anything that was shot, you know, in seconds. We need it done really quickly. This maximizes creativity time and minimizes searching time. Then, in a high percentage of scene constructions, we move on to what's known as a sync pull, which, as we've talked about, is a rough selection of interview speech from a character or a set of characters that is molded and shaped into a coherent narrative. Now, anyone who knows how and what I teach at Inside the Edit knows that I'm a massive fan of getting our sync pulls pretty tight before we start painting B-roll over them. You know, if we don't, we can often cause all kinds of negative and time-consuming issues later on. As the saying goes, we don't want to build a castle on quicksand. Our foundations have to be strong, and so a tightly defined sync pull often forms the spine or skeleton of many sequences. You know, we need to know what is essential and what is not. Now, we talked through a fantastic technique in episode 10, I think it was, that can help us in the selection and streamlining of content. If you haven't already listened to that episode where we talk about the literary technique Chekhov's gun, go back and definitely give it a listen. It's a really useful concept to learn. But like anything as complex as high-end editing, there are always different perspectives to approach similar or related parts of an art form. The goal or destination, of course, is the same. We want a beautiful sequence. But there's always a different path up the mountain. And looking at the same issue or a related issue, but from a different point of view, can often be the thing that gives us that, you know, that light bulb moment of realization. I want us to look at sync pull construction from the perspective of one of the most powerful weapons in the editor's arsenal, compression. No, it's not what you're thinking. We're not going to talk about bit rates and codecs and how you turn 4K into proxy files and, you know, stuff like that. There's plenty of places to find out about all that tech stuff. The type of compression we're talking about here is journalistic compression. Now, let's take a slight detour for a moment and think about the parallels between editing and journalism, especially print journalism, you know, the kind you find in your daily newspaper. So a journalist is working with pre-existing elements, i.e. the chain of events that is happening or has happened in any given story. An editor works with pre-existing content too, but for us it's shot and interview sync. You know, our content is a lot more finite and ring-fenced. A journalist has to burrow down through a huge amount of white noise to find the key facts that tell the story that they want to tell. Again, this is very similar to what editors do. We usually have an enormous amount of footage that will never make it into our film, a huge amount of white noise, whether that be a two-minute news report or a two-hour documentary that we're making. A journalist also has to take the main elements and facts of the story. These could be in many different forms, quotes from a person or an institution or, you know, a group of people or a company, high-level research from reputable sources to build context or add things like historical perspective. It's a pretty long list. And they take all these elements And here's the really important point. They take them all and they compress them. They summarize them. They could never fit everything in. After all, this is an article they're writing. It's not a book. They have a definitive amount of column inches. And so every single word counts. And of course, this is a major part of unscripted editing genres as well. We have to heavily compress what an interview character is talking about from sometimes really long and drawn-out answers. We've got to compress it down to just a few minutes. We can't allow the whole uncut answer or set of answers that a person took to explain this thing, or we'd have like a 30-hour film by the time we were finished. We take what was said on one particular subject, you know, that could be 5 minutes or 20 minutes, and we have to cut it down to its bare minimum. We have to get the scissors out and ask ourselves, how do we tell this story in the least possible time and still get all the necessary facts in? You know, in a drama, there's the lines in the script that were methodically written and rewritten by the screenwriter and then rehearsed by the actors. That is incredibly finite in terms of content and potential sync reconstructions, as you only have a very small percentage of leeway in what you can cut. Don't get me wrong, drama editing is incredibly complicated and has its own unique set of rules, which you just don't find anywhere else. But in unscripted, our job is to act as journalists, or if you like, as a kind of retrospective screenwriter, as we choose what's important out of thousands of possible combinations and constructions during a prolonged interview to camera. And here's the final part. After a journalist has looked through and studied the event, found all of their content, got rid of all the excess, and compressed what they've chosen down to digestible chunks of information, they then have to weave it together into a narrative. I mean, journalists even call it a story. What story are you working on? This final part of their job is again mirrored in our art form. Facts, sync, and shots, without order, without an intelligent structure, are just noise. It's narrative that keeps people watching. It's using the tried and tested constructions of storytelling that keep people engaged. We have to select, compress, and then reorder what's been given to us and make it digestible for the audience in an interesting, dramatic, or entertaining way, depending on what genre we're working in. Now, of course, there are also huge differences between what we do and what journalists do. But what I've always found really fascinating is that when I read an expertly written and well-researched article, it's so easy to see a meticulous storytelling mind at work, and it can be a thing of beauty. First principles are at play in this whole constructive process, and in both art forms. But knowing what we know about the sheer power to persuade and convince by this very process of compression, selection, and deselection, it brings up some important points to delve into. As editors, we can see that we have a huge amount of responsibility to stay as close to the facts and truth as is humanly possible. But it's also important to point out that both editing and journalism are not impartial. Far from it. We are always taking a stand. We're always planting a flag and telling the audience what we see from this particular perspective. It is impossible to do otherwise. I always tell people new to our craft, you know, especially if they want to work in the heavily journalistic genres like news or documentaries, to go off and carry out an interesting experiment. Go down to your local shop early one morning and buy a copy of the top 5 newspapers in your city or country. Now, it's likely that a high percentage of the stories on the first, say, 3 to 6 pages will be exactly the same. But here's the thing. The way they are reported is often very different. Each newspaper has its own voice or editorial line or ideology, whatever you want to call it. And they'll interpret the facts through that editorial line, which is in turn based on the readers that they represent in, you know, any given country. It's actually amazing how talented journalists can interpret facts in different ways through different perspectives. Study them closely, and you find that they do this by techniques like reordering the same facts to create different context and meaning, or exaggerating and embellishing one area of the argument while playing down and even skipping over others, which gives the ability to draw different conclusions from the same facts. I guess it's not unlike two attorneys in a big court case. You know, a defense attorney and a prosecuting attorney will both interpret the same facts in two extremely different ways. How many courtroom drama films have we watched that have this in? You know, the real genius isn't a massive distortion of the facts. It's in the subtle and many shades of grey that sound incredibly probable. I mean, I always remind myself of how many times I've changed my mind when I'm confronted by two brilliantly argued points of view. You can go back and forwards like watching a game of table tennis. And they've both used the concept of first principles in their journalistic compression. They break the same elements down into their individual parts, throw away the noise, and piece what's left together into a coherent whole, each one designing a unique path for the audience to walk down. And this construction in a newspaper article or even a sink poll is not just made up of everything that was used. It was also made up of everything that wasn't used as well. I'm always reminded of that famous literary saying, omission is the greatest form of lying. It's a quote that I think is often attributed to the genius writer George Orwell, even though I don't think it appears in any of his writing. But, you know, even if he didn't say it, it still makes us think about the fact that leaving something out is often more powerful and potentially more distorting to a story than putting something in. These are the things that we have to consider every single time that we compress information. Yes, we have to compress, you know, just by the sheer nature of the medium we're in. We can't show 20-minute interview answers in any genre. But what we also have to consider is that during that compression, we need to be as true and as authentic to the situation and to the facts at hand in order to give our audience as pure an explanation as possible. The journalist's and the editor's job walks that razor's edge between how effective a narrative is and the ethical implications of selection, reordering, and deselection of content. So how do we go about starting to learn this immensely powerful and useful trait? A trait that is not just built for documentary makers, it's just as useful for news cutters, promo editors, and corporate film editors, basically anywhere, you know, where there's real-life people that are being interviewed and their answers need journalistic compression and reordering. Well, here's a great preliminary exercise. Go out and buy a newspaper. Choose an article and get a pair of scissors. Your task is to use the scissors to cut out and distill the meaning of that really large article down to a couple of sentences or just one paragraph. And you do it with the scissors. Yes, it's old school, but what it does to the mind is extremely powerful. It is pure summarization. All the words are there, just like the raw footage of our interview clips. You also got a pair of scissors, which is just like our editing software. And you have to compress the meaning of the story down while still keeping all the necessary facts there for the audience. What is essential and what is not? what can be thrown away and what can't. You'll learn a ton, and it'll only cost you the price of a newspaper. Much as I'd like to take credit for creating this exercise, I can't. It was given to me by an incredibly talented editor I was talking to recently, who learnt it at the very start of their career. He's going to remain nameless for now, as hopefully, schedule permitting, we're going to get him on the show as a guest real soon. Like everything we teach at Inside the Edit, I encourage you to do it over and over again so that you can make it a creative reflex. The more you do it, the better you get. Go back to first principles. Clear the deck. Come from that place of complete naive ignorance. Build something complex, but most of all, make it look beautifully simple. That is the art of journalistic sync compression. So it's time for this week's Q&A, and we've got a really interesting one this week from Stuart in South Africa. This really is a topic that deserves some discussion, so I'm going to read out Stuart's email in full. Hi, Paddy. Firstly, I love listening to your podcasts and look forward each week to a new one. As a doc editor, I especially appreciate the insights and the experiences that you and your guest editors share with fellow filmmakers. Thank you. That's great to hear, Stuart. This is exactly the kind of spirit that we want to cultivate for our community. So it's great to hear that you're enjoying Once Upon a Timeline. Stuart goes on to say, some of the films I work on deal with wildlife trade and conservation issues, mostly hard-hitting issues, whether it be tigers being farmed for body parts, rhinos poached for their horns, illegal trade in ivory, and so forth. These are generally self-funded by the producers I work with, and filming on some of these stories takes years. It's been my experience that the independent producers battle to market the films to broadcasters and distributors who seem to insist that films should have a happy ending, when in most cases there is no happy ending. Entertainment seems to be the key driver, and a factual approach is deemed as not good storytelling. At times, I think this could be misleading audiences. It's probably true to say that most audiences are aware of threats to nature and wildlife, and many react by pushing the donate button and then move on with their lives while wildlife and biodiversity continue to disappear at an alarming rate. What is your take on entertainment as key driver versus a hard-hitting factual approach to documentary filmmaking? Can the two coexist in a film? How do we get audiences to pay attention and then to react positively by merely donating money? I'd love to hear a conversation around this. Well, what a great question and discussion topic, Stuart. Thank you so much for sending it in. This is exactly the type of conversation that I love having on Once Upon a Timeline, and one that, you know, I'm really proud to be involved in. So let me give you my thoughts. The type of films that you're working on are totally the type of films that the independent documentary community should be championed for and are amazing at producing. For me, I mean, it really is so inspiring to hear about and to watch the docs of dedicated filmmakers highlighting and championing causes that affect life on our planet, whether they be political, economic, social, cultural, or from the natural world. Calls to action, revealing injustice, and informing the public are just some of the noble intentions of the well-crafted modern documentary. But as we know, they are fighting an uphill battle, you know, with the oversaturation of content from tons of different sources. The film-going public are spoiled for choice nowadays, and it seems like, you know, doc filmmakers are shouting to be heard from within a much larger crowd of fellow filmmaking artists. We're also constantly reminded of the fact that documentaries hardly ever turn a profit. Doc makers do it for the love. They do it for the message and they do it for the art. You know, I remember looking at the financials of successful documentaries over the years. I think this was, you know, a couple of years ago. And I remember seeing that the only documentary filmmaker who seems to have actually turned anywhere near a consistent profit is actually Michael Moore. The legendary doc filmmaker and Oscar winner Errol Morris, one of my heroes, he subsidizes his doc-making career by making commercials. Docs rarely make it into the cinema, and the few that do cross over into mainstream theatrical release are never there for the same amount of time, you know, that a drama would be, and also only in very selected, usually art house cinemas. That being said, there's never been a better time in terms of getting our docs out there to an audience with the rise of so many different streaming platforms. And so I don't think it's all doom and gloom at all. There's actually a lot to be hopeful about, and I think the next few years are going to be really interesting in the documentary community. But your points around entertainment as key driver versus hard-hitting factual are really interesting, Stuart, and definitely warrant some deeper discussion. Let's start off with some cold, hard facts. Less people watch hard-hitting factual than do entertainment. I mean, the difference in numbers is just staggering. Hard-hitting factual has a much smaller audience, and that's just a simple fact. Now, getting into the philosophical reasons for why this is a fact is more nebulous, in my opinion. We're moving into questions around the medium of film and how people engage with it, you know, after a hard day's work or as a social event with loved ones at the weekend and stuff like that. Fantasy versus reality and the human need for escapism and humor as a way to combat and alleviate our sometimes difficult lives. You know, it's a complex discussion to have, and I think it's a whole subject in itself. Now, we could sit here all day and discuss the reasons why people engage more with entertainment, but if viewing figures and therefore awareness of our film and the issues it highlights are the actual goal, then looking at what successful filmmakers have done in related films is a really good case study, and therefore, in my opinion, a really intelligent way to analyze the market. Look at the team who, over the last decade and a half, have completely dominated the natural history filmmaking market. The incredibly talented team who made the Blue Planet and the Planet Earth series, amongst many others. One of my greatest career regrets was that even though I made quite a few documentaries at the BBC over the years, I never got into that department to work with that filmmaking team and, of course, the legendary Sir David Attenborough. Now, what's interesting about looking at this group of filmmakers and their output is the actual way they structure and cut their films. And this is where it really gets interesting for me, as it goes to the very core of the changes in documentaries that have been happening over the last 20 years. If we study any of these nature films, you can see that they've moved away from the more traditional observational point of view that existed, you know, for decades in terms of the tone and the feeling of the films. And they've actually anthropomorphized the shooting and, most importantly, the editing. Now, to those who don't know what anthropomorphized means, it simply means that they've deliberately cut the characters in the films, whether they be snow leopards or elephants or penguins, they've cut them with human characteristics and from a human behavioral point of view, despite them being animals. They've cut their interactions with the other animals like a drama, like an action sequence. They've used music that highlights and emphasizes their characters and behaviors, just like a drama editor does, as well as a host of other editing techniques that reinforce this unique perspective for the audience. So what's the net result? Well, the audience is far more drawn to them as characters and therefore care a lot more about what happens to them. The psychology behind all these decisions is incredibly powerful and incredibly sophisticated. Yeah, the cinematography is stunning and many of these episodes, used cutting-edge technology that really enabled them to get into places and film things that had never been seen by humans before, let alone captured on camera. But these filmmakers have used drama-cutting techniques within the framework of observational documentary. They got major Hollywood composers like Hans Zimmer to write drama-type scores and therefore got audiences to connect a lot more deeply with the characters, i.e. the wildlife, and our planet as a whole. In my mind, this is a highly intelligent perspective that really caught on to what was going on over the last few decades within an audience's mind and adapted accordingly to create the most effective message possible. Does this taint the original intention and message of the film by entertainmentifying it? That is definitely not a word, but you know what I'm saying. I mean, who can say? I guess there are good arguments on both sides. A spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. And we can lament the lack of purity in the art form, but we'll never fix that, as our art form is a progressive one that constantly changes and evolves. Or in my opinion, we can adapt and use dramatic filmmaking techniques taken from drama to reach the most amount of people possible. If you go back and listen to the podcast episodes we did with doc editor Will Znederek, we touch on this subject a bit there as well. There really is a revolution going on in documentaries as they've moved away from the rather dry and journalistic films they were 20 years ago to the more cinematic and entertaining styles they are today. Many doc filmmakers have realized that it's difficult to compete for the audience's attention with the multi-billion dollar Marvel Cinematic Universe, and so they are using many of the narrative and stylizational techniques found in mainstream dramas. The age of the dusty old format of slow-moving and dry reporter-led documentaries is pretty much over, it seems, and this new generation of doc audiences wants all the drama of cinema in their docs. They want cinematic techniques, stylized cutting patterns, film score level music, and narrative structures that mirror the complexity and nuance that they are used to watching in their sophisticated and long-running drama series. These are the docs that are doing really well right now. Of course, there's always exceptions to the rule, and if a story, event, or subject is so powerful, and the access that the filmmakers have is incredibly strong, then that can be enough to make a documentary a hit with an audience. But I've also seen incredibly interesting stories in docs not hit anywhere near the power they could have because they were not crafted well in the edit. Remember, in our art form, sophistication is in the minute subtleties. We are, after all, the invisible artists. No one really knows what we do within the industry, let alone the members of the film going public. For me, I'd be researching everything, studying the structures and cutting patterns and music use of everything from the most successful nature docs to anthropomorphized Disney films like The Lion King to see if there was anything I could pick up in terms of editorial techniques. And above all, the questions I would be asking myself would be ones like, who is my target audience? What moves them the most? And how do I turn my raw footage into the most powerful version of itself for that audience? I hope this answers your question, Stuart, and thanks so much for sending it in. I really do wish you the very best of luck and applaud the amazing work you're doing, my friend. These stories need to be told, and I hope your films get the support and coverage that they deserve. If you have an opinion or any experience in what we've talked about and you'd love to share it, please do drop me an email. I think it's a fascinating and incredibly relevant topic in our community right now. Of course, if you have any creative questions at all and you'd like to hear them on the show, just email podcast@insidetheedit.com and we'll get it on a future episode. Don't forget, if you'd like to learn any of the high-end editing techniques we talk about on this podcast, head on over to insidetheedit.com and you can sign up for our 2-week free trial. There is a ton of free content as well as a discount code for our full creative editing course. We turn you into a powerful creative editor. If you love creative editing and are sick of editing courses and film schools that promise creativity but only teach you the technical side of software, and if you want to do it in a live environment, then our new Inside the Edit Bootcamp may be exactly what you're looking for. We're just a very short time away now from having the new Bootcamp section up on the site, and you'll be able to see what we're offering and register your interest. Due to the massive success and selling out of all of our 2-week master's degree tasters over the summer, we've had an unprecedented amount of requests to start up regular live training. So many of us prefer short bursts of intense learning and also doing it in a live environment where we can ask questions and have that interaction. This is exactly what we're going to be doing with Inside the Edit Bootcamp. We're going to pack an enormous amount of creative theory and analysis into a weekend. Each bootcamp will be themed around a specific part of our craft, so you can choose the creative areas that are relevant to you and the skills you want to sharpen. It's such an exciting new area for us at Inside the Edit, and I can't wait to show you more when the bootcamp page goes live on insidetheedit.com. So it's time for this week's competition. We're giving away a digital download of all the raw footage to our short documentary, Off the Grid. The film follows Dave, an ex-Special Forces soldier who lives in a tent on top of some cliffs on the south coast of England. The Royal Marine has a compelling and moving story as he describes his life and the trauma he had trying to integrate back into society after a lifetime of soldiering around the world. It's the perfect short documentary to practice cutting with, and as usual, we also provide all of the interview transcripts to help you craft the perfect film. You can take a look on our online store at shop.insidetheedit.com. Now, all you have to do to win is tell us which episode of Once Upon a Timeline has been your favorite so far, and most importantly, why. Send your name, answer, and where you live in an email to podcast@insidetheedit.com, and we'll pick the winner on next week's show. A massive shout out, as always, to the fantastic team over at Universal Production Music, who supply all of the tracks to every single episode of Once Upon a Timeline. This week, I really got into the solo piano tracks, actually. Probably inspired by the fact that Hannibal Lecter's favorite music track in all three of the Lecter films is one of Bach's beautiful Goldberg variations. I've used some lovely tracks on the podcast this week, and if you think they'd be good for what you're cutting right now, head on over to the episode 14 page on insidetheedit.com. We've put in all the usual links to every single track we've used, so you can go and view them on Universal Production Music's website. As this is a completely free resource and we want it to do well, please don't forget to share it with friends and colleagues wherever you can, and especially on your social media channels. And of course, if you really want to help us out, please do leave a review on Apple Podcasts. I really, really appreciate it. I hope you've enjoyed this week's show, my dear friends, and I will see you very soon on another episode of Once Upon a Timeline. Stay cool. Please stay safe and stay cutting.